You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Wonderful to have you with us. And you don't have to be a baseball fan to enjoy what we're going to talk about next. It's a truly dramatic, only in Hollywood kind of story. And it essentially did happen in Hollywood. The 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers, a last hurrah for the historically long-lived infield of Garvey, Lopes, Russell, and Say, a last chance to try and get a championship out of that team. And the story of that Dodger year is told in Jason Turbo's brand new book, They Bled Blue. Fernando Mania, strike season mayhem, and the weirdest championship baseball had ever seen, the 1981 LA Dodgers. But let's go back. Vin Scully calling Fernando Valenzuela at the plate in this magical 1981 season of Fernando Mania.
1-1 to Guerrero. Ratcher comes back to his hitter, and there's a drive into deep left field. Back goes White. It's gone, Fernando. It's gone. What's going on here? The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all. The Fernando Valenzuela magic is alive and well. Who's to say when it will end?
Wonderful, as always, to hear the great Vin Scully with that call. Jason Turbo with us to talk about a remarkable year. Jason, welcome.
Thank you for having me. And man, listening to Vin Scully order lunch would be a thing of beauty.
Isn't it great, let alone something as dramatic as that home run? Set the stage for this season, because a lot was going on. We had a strike, which cut the season in two. I mentioned the aging infield. Lopes, the oldest, I think he was 36 at that point, but the others getting long in the tooth. This had a lot riding on it.
Correct. I mean, the infield had been together for going on nine seasons, which, is, to put it in some context, is about twice as long as the next most durable infield in Major League history. These guys had been through three World Series together. They knew their time was short. The Dodgers farm system was loaded with talent. And to a man, they knew if they were going to win a championship, 1981 had to be the year, because they weren't going to all be together in 1982. What they didn't count on was a kid coming from out of nowhere, setting the world aflame, as we just heard Vin Scully talk about. And Fernando Valenzuela really was the difference for the Dodgers between a lost season and a championship season that year.
This 20-year-old who comes essentially from nowhere, speaks only Spanish. Now, the Dodgers had Latino fans. I was a kid going to Dodger Stadium. I saw a lot of Latinos at the stadium. But it hadn't really reached a critical mass. The Dodgers had long been trying to have that connection, even as fans listened to the broadcast from Jaime Harin on KWKW. They weren't getting the turnout that they ideally wanted.
That's right, and that's because of the Dodgers' kind of fraught history with Los Angeles before they arrived. I mean, once in Chavez Ravine was a thriving Mexican community, thousands strong in the early 1900s, that changed in about 1949, when the Los Angeles mayor decided that he wanted to build a housing project in Chavez Ravine. He displaced the community of Mexicans in order to secure this land. In 1953, I believe, he was ousted by a conservative Republican who branded subsidized housing as a socialist plot. You know, it was the height of the McCarthy era, and he scuttled the project entirely. Right, that left Los Angeles with a bunch of empty acreage and not much to do with it until Walter O'Malley decided he wanted to move his team out of Brooklyn. And it worked. I mean, the Dodgers, their last season in Brooklyn, sold about a million tickets. Their first season in Los Angeles, playing in the L.A. Coliseum, they about doubled that. For the next 4 years, they played in the Coliseum, while in Chavez Ravine, the mountains were leveled and valleys were graded, and Dodger Stadium was built. And once that ballpark opened, they set new attendance records almost every season.
They arrived just at the time, too, as L.A.'s in the midst of a post-war expansion in population, so it's rising dramatically. And you have a lot of people who arrived from the East Coast who knew baseball, and all we had were two minor league teams here, the Hollywood Stars, the Los Angeles Angels, and the Dodgers were truly embraced. Let's talk a bit about how this team had really struggled in the 70s, despite all this talent. There was always the Cincinnati Reds in the Western Division that the Dodgers had to contend with. And the years they did get to the World Series, the New York Yankees were an obstacle.
That's right. They lost the World Series to the Oakland A's in 1974, made it back in 1977, got beat by the Yankees. Reggie Jackson hit a very famous three home runs in three swings. 1978, the Dodgers again played the Yankees, won the first two games, felt very much in control of their destiny, and then lost four straight. So they were delighted to get back to the World Series to have that chance. The Reds really stood in their way in a very, very major fashion. Even in 1981, the Dodgers, despite getting out to an incredibly hot start, were backsliding something mighty in late May and early June. They had a 6.5-game divisional lead over Cincinnati and were losing almost a game a day in ground. The Reds were catching up to them inexorably. The lead was down to a half a game, which is where the Dodgers got very lucky, because at that very moment, the Players Union decided to strike. And it's not fanciful to think that if the strike had occurred even one day later, the Dodgers might have lost that divisional lead. And that matters because baseball's reaction to the strike, which cost them 50 days of the season right in the middle, was to crown first half champions and second half champions. And that guaranteed the Dodgers a spot in the postseason. They held on by the skin of their teeth to that first half championship. They did not win the second half championship. Ron Say got injured. They struggled mightily in the last few weeks of the season. They didn't even finish with the best overall record in the National League West.
Wasn't Cincinnati?
Cincinnati did. Cincinnati did. They didn't even make the playoffs, owing to the fact they won neither the first nor the second half championship. So the Reds were definitely the Dodgers' bugbear that year, but it didn't help them any. The Dodgers made the playoffs, and the Reds didn't.
This quirk of the format, but the Dodgers still big underdogs going into the playoffs because they'd had such a weak second half.
That's right. They were dealing with injury. They were dealing with ineffectiveness. Fernando himself, after a world-beating start, literally just about the best start to a career in baseball history. His first eight starts of the season resulted in eight victories. He pitched nine innings in every single one of those games. He threw five shutouts. His ERA was 0.5, which, if you don't know, is really, really good. He had some rough starts in the middle of the season, but he came back strong, and he rounded into form just as the playoffs struck. To get back to one of your earlier questions, the Dodgers' inability to capture a Mexican fan base because of the displaced community in Chavez Ravine, Fernando Mania, which was in full bloom by the time he hit his fourth or fifth victory, turned that grandstand at Dodger Stadium into a giant mariachi party. Like, Al Campanis, the team's general manager, had long been saying that he wanted to find a Mexican Sandy Koufax, someone to activate Mexicans the way that Koufax had activated Jews. And he could not do it for 20 years leading up to 1981. Fernando gave him that guy, and almost overnight, that demographic, which was not insignificant, more Mexicans lived in L.A. County than anywhere in the world outside of Mexico City, that demographic was entirely activated.
Well, it's so ironic here, you know, with Mexico and Southern California next to each other, but Mexico did not produce large numbers of Major League Baseball players, unlike much smaller countries like the Dominican Republic, other Spanish-speaking countries where baseball, big part of the sports culture, produced a lot of players. Mexico didn't produce so many, and that made it very difficult for the Dodgers to find that gem.
That's right. I mean, unlike these other leagues in the Dominican and Venezuela, which compete during the winter and thus fold in Major League players as part of an off-season training regimen, the Mexican League competes during the summer, didn't want to lose its star players to Major League Baseball, and thus tended to price them beyond the interest of big league teams. It wasn't that there was a lack of talent. Mexican league teams just didn't want to give up their players.
We're talking with Jason Turbo, author of They Bled Blue, Fernando Mania, Strike Season Mayhem, and the Weirdest Championship Baseball Had Ever Seen, the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers. The 88 team, of course, gets so much attention because of Kirk Gibson's epic home run. They were underdogs there, too, against the Oakland A's. And that series took on a kind of mythical standing because of Gibson barely able to stand hitting that home run. But this 1981 team was absolutely key because of all the sorts of freakish things behind the scenes. And you also had this longest lasting intact infield with Garvey Lopes, Russell Say, which were barely on speaking terms with each other, but nonetheless had been very effective, a very, very potent infield. I'd like to hear from you if you're someone who fondly remembers that 1981 team, and a particular memory of one of those players sticks in your mind. We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPECC. It's a chance for you to share your memories of that 1981 Dodger team. I was one of those, you know, teenage kids who lived and died with every Dodger game through the 1970s with this infield. And also players, Reggie Smith, just a huge part, heart and soul of that team. Dusty Baker, of course, Rick Monday, Steve Yeager, the catcher, Don Sutton, the pitcher, others that were indelible parts of that, Andy Messersmith, 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jason Turbo grew up a San Francisco Giants fan, but we'll excuse that because he's written a really terrific book on the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers, the team that was his boyhood nemesis, now the source of a terrific book that he researched and wrote, titled They Bled Blue, Fernando Mania, Strike Season Mayhem, and the Weirdest Championship Baseball Had Ever Seen, tells the story of the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers. Jason is going to be at Santa Monica's Diesel Bookstore tomorrow night at 6:30. And then he's going to be with sports writer Ron Rappaport talking about Fernando Mania Thursday night at the South Pasadena Library. That's a free event, starts at 7 o'clock. We have links with information on both the Diesel Books event tomorrow night and the South Pasadena Public Library event Thursday night on our AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Very pleased to have joining us, it's Rick Salinas of Silver Lake of Culture Clash, am I correct?
Yes. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm really good. I just want to quickly share that our most popular play that we've written, Chavez Ravine, which premiered at the Mark Taper Forum, we wrote the whole story of Chavez Ravine. The three of us, you know, Richard Montoya, Herbert Siguenza, portrayed 55 characters and did the whole story of Chavez Ravine. But what we did, and I wanted to share with you, is that we used Fernando Valenzuela as our bookend. It opens up with him and then the spirits and the ghosts of some of the people that lived up there. They whisper in his ear and they tell him, come on, go do it, Fernando. And at the end, he strikes out the Houston Astros and he wins. And everyone would tell us, my home is right below home base. And there was a custom where they would bury the belly buttons when you were born and they would bury them under the house. So everybody would tell us, yeah, my belly button's under home base.
How funny.
So it was just a great opportunity to use Fernando, and everyone that we interviewed said the same thing. They said that they did not go back to the stadium until they learned about Fernando.
Hey, Rick, thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate it. And it was a great production at the Taper, and appreciate you talking about the piece Chavez Ravine, Culture Clashes. Rick Salinas joining us on Air Talk. If you have a particular memory of that 1981 Fernando Mania, Los Angeles Dodgers strike-interrupted championship season, 866 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. You can also comment on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jason, let's talk a bit about the fraught relations between the Dodgers that have been together all these years, starting in the minor leagues. They arrive in Los Angeles. Very different personalities, the four men.
Absolutely. It's remarkable how well they played together on the field, considering I wouldn't call it antipathy off the field, but let's say they didn't hang out a lot together once they left the ballpark. I mean, Steve Garvey had this all-American image of you know, kissing all the babies and hugging all the nuns, and he didn't curse, and he was Captain America, and that image was genuine. Like, it wasn't a front for the public. He meant everything he said and everything he did. But he also tended to perhaps grandstand about it a little bit more than his teammates would care for, in the sense that, you know, he looked at someone who maybe didn't hang around and sign all the autographs with a little bit more disdain than they would have cared for. So there was some tension there. Garvey had, through no fault of his own, a pretty scattershot throwing arm. He was a great athlete. He played defensive back on the Michigan State football team. He got injured in college playing football, that ruined much of his accuracy.
I actually was at Dodger Stadium where I think it was his first game playing third base just after he was brought up. But he made an error, as he did many, and they gave up on him being a third baseman.
Correct. He led the league in errors in playing only 85 games as a third baseman. His arm was just not tenable at the major league level. He turned into a very, very good first baseman. His fielding was terrific. But when he had to complete double plays, again, his fellow infielders sometimes held that against him.
He was a very good defensive first baseman, though, I would argue.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's an argument. He won a gold glove. He was an excellent first baseman, except when it came time to throw across the diamond.
Exactly. And Davey Lopes, who had a little bit more of a, I don't know what you'd call it, not exuberant personality, a little more.
Davey Lopes was the most outspoken guy on the team, perhaps right alongside Reggie Smith. But Lopes had this amazing moment during the strike when, unbeknownst to him, they were very close to settling. The players' union and the owners were about to come to an understanding when Lopes gave an interview to a local newspaper here in Southern California, questioning everything, questioning the union's leadership, questioning their rationale for striking, not knowing why they weren't playing. And that was all ownership needed to see cracks in the veneer of what had appeared to be a very solidified union. And suddenly talks were set back several steps. It took some time for Lopes to understand this. But by the time he did, he came to the players' union meeting in Los Angeles and, as was his way, owned every mistake he had made. He apologized to the group. He talked to the press about how he had been wrong and how the union was right, which I think is a really admirable trait for somebody as off-the-cuff outspoken as Davey Lopes. And that's one thing his teammates very much respected. As angry as they had been at him beforehand, they all came to forgive him afterward.
My sense of Reggie Smith is that he spoke with a kind of gravitas that that maybe carried more weight with his teammates. But what in your conversations, what is your sense? My sense is that he was held in quite high regard.
He was. His teammates respected him to no end. 1981 was a very difficult year for him because he had injured his shoulder severely the previous year. He was unable to play the field entirely through the duration of 1981. He got in a couple innings at first base toward the end of the year, but almost every one of his appearances was as a pinch hitter. He couldn't play the field, and that wrecked him emotionally. It was hard for him to take not being able to play as well as he wanted to.
We're talking with Jason Turbo. His book, They Bled Blue, Fernando Mania, Strike Season Mayhem, and the Weirdest Championship Baseball Had Ever Seen, the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers, who in a strike-interrupted season by virtue of winning the first half of the season by a half game over the Reds, go into the playoffs, the league championship series, go to the World Series against the New York Yankees. They had two previous setbacks in the late 1970s against the Yankees. Did the players tell you that you interviewed there was any sense of dread about, you know, the third time, or did they feel like this was finally going to be their chance?
Very much the latter. I don't think anyone was afraid of the Yankees. One thing that going to three World Series prior to that point taught everybody was how to approach a postseason series in an effective manner. They knew that not only every game counted and not only every inning counted, but every single pitch counted. And their focus was beyond reproach. And I don't think you could say the same thing for those Yankees teams. They made a lot of fundamental errors on which the Dodgers capitalized throughout that postseason, both from the manager and the players themselves. They saw this, these Dodgers, as redemption. I mean, they'd lost to the Yankees twice in a row in increasingly dispiriting fashion. Lasorda could not have been happier to get the Yankees as an opponent.
And it's quite remarkable that Lasorda was such a big personality and, you know, I'm sure his players at times rolling their eyes and, you know, looking at Tommy as almost a character, that he was able to lead them to not just this 81 World Series victory, but the one in 88, too.
Yeah, he was a larger-than-life personality from the time he was a minor league pitcher in the Dodgers system. He spent 8 years managing in the minor leagues for the Dodgers.
And he was a national baseball celebrity as a minor league manager.
He was a cult, a one-man cult of personality. The funny part is, naysayers said that it wouldn't work in the major leagues. But it did, because his players who played for him in the big leagues also played for him in the minors. They knew what they were getting. He kept it right up, and they knew who he was.
And somehow, even with the motivational techniques he used, that they knew exactly what he was doing, it still worked.
Yeah. And that group of that infield that ended in 1981 all came up with Lasorda.
Jason, thanks so much. I appreciate it. His book, They Bled Blue, Jason Turbo, our guest.